letter to my father. Dear Dad, urgent. Please wire $50 right away to Onitsuka Corp of Kobe. Ho ho, hee hee, strange things are happening. Back in my hotel, I walked in circles around my tatami mat, trying to decide. Part of me wanted to hurry home, wait for those samples, get a jump on my new business venture. Also, I was crazed with loneliness, cut off from everything and everyone I knew. The occasional sight of a New York Times or a Time magazine gave me a lump in my throat. I was a castaway, a kind of modern Crusoe. I wanted to be home again, now. On the other hand, I was still aflame with curiosity. I still wanted to see, to explore. Curiosity won. I decided to go on. I went to Hong Kong and walked the mad, chaotic streets, horrified by the sight of legless, armless beggars, old men kneeling in filth alongside pleading orphans. The old men were mute, but the children had a cry they repeated, "Hey, rich man, hey, rich man, hey, rich man." Then they'd weep or slap the ground. Even after I gave them all the money in my pockets, the cry never stopped. I went to the edge of the city, climbed to the top of Victoria Peak, gazed off into the distance at China. In college, I'd read the Analects of Confucius. The man who moves a mountain begins by carrying away small stones. And now I felt strongly that I'd never have a chance to move this particular mountain. I'd never get any closer to that mystical land, and it made me feel unaccountably sad, incomplete. I went to the Philippines, which had all the madness and chaos of Hong Kong and twice the poverty. I moved slowly, as if in a nightmare, through Manila, through endless crowds and fathomless gridlock, toward the hotel where MacArthur once occupied the penthouse. I was fascinated by all the great generals, from Alexander the Great to George Patton. I hated war, but I loved the warrior's spirit. I hated the sword, but loved the samurai. And of all the great fighting men in history, I found MacArthur the most compelling. Those Ray-Bans, that corncob pipe, the man didn't lack for confidence. Brilliant tactician, master motivator. He also went on to head the U.S. Olympic Committee. How could I not love him? Of course, he was deeply flawed, but he knew that. "You are remembered," he said prophetically, "for the rules you break." I wanted to book a night in his former suite, but I couldn't afford it. One day, I vowed, one day I shall return. I went to Bangkok, where I rode a long pole boat through murky swamps to an open-air market that seemed a Thai version of Hieronymus Bosch. I ate birds and fruits and vegetables I'd never seen before and never would again. I dodged rickshaws, scooters, tuk-tuks, and elephants to reach Wat Prakau, and one of the most sacred statues in Asia, an enormous 600-year-old Buddha carved from a single hunk of jade. Standing before its placid face, I asked, "Why am I here? What is my purpose?" I waited. Nothing. Or else the silence was my answer. I went to Vietnam, where streets were bristling with American soldiers and thrumming with fear. Everyone knew that war was coming and that it would be very ugly, very different. It would be a Lewis Carroll war, the kind in which a U.S. officer would declare, "We had to destroy the village in order to save it." Days before Christmas 1962, I went on to Calcutta and rented a room the size of a coffin, no bed, no chair. There was no space, just a hammock suspended above a fizzing hole, the toilet. Within hours, I fell ill, an airborne virus probably, or else food poisoning. For one whole day, I believed that I wouldn't make it. I felt in my heart that I was going to die. But I rallied somehow, forced myself out of that hammock, and the next day, I was walking unsteadily with thousands of pilgrims and dozens of sacred monkeys down the steep staircase of Varanasi Temple. The steps led directly into the hot, seething Ganges. When the water was at my waist, I looked up. A mirage? No, a funeral, taking place in the middle of the river. In fact, several funerals. I watched mourners wade out into the current and place their loved ones atop tall wooden biers, then set them afire. Not 20 yards away, others were calmly bathing. Still others were slaking their thirst with the same water. The Upanishad say, "Lead me from the unreal to the real." So I fled the unreal. I flew to Kathmandu and hiked straight up the clean white wall of the Himalayas. On the descent, I stopped at a crowded chowk and devoured a bowl of buffalo meat, blood rare. The Tibetans in the chowk, I noted, wore boots of red wool and green flannel with upturned wooden toes, not unlike the runners on sleds. Suddenly I was noticing everyone's shoes. I went back to India, spent New Year's Eve wandering the streets of Bombay, weaving in and out among oxen and long-horned cows, feeling the start of an epic migraine, the noise and the smells, the colors and the glare. I went on to Kenya and took a long bus ride deep into the bush. Giant ostriches tried to outrun the bus, and storks the size of pit bulls floated just outside the windows. Every time the driver stopped, in the middle of nowhere, to pick up a few Maasai warriors, a baboon or two would try to board. The driver and warriors would then chase the baboons off with machetes. Before stepping off the bus, the baboons would always glance over their shoulders and give me a look of wounded pride. Sorry, old man, I thought, if it were up to me. I went to Cairo, to the Giza Plateau, and stood beside desert nomads and their silk-draped camels at the foot of the Great Sphinx, all of us squinting up into its eternally open eyes. The sun hammered down on my head, the same sun that hammered down on the thousands of men who built these pyramids, and the millions of visitors who came after. Not one of them was remembered, I thought. All is vanity, says the Bible. All is now, says Zen. All is dust, says the desert. I went to Jerusalem, to the rock where Abraham prepared to kill his son, where Mohammed began his heavenward ascent. The Quran says the rock wanted to join Mohammed and tried to follow, but Mohammed pressed his foot to the rock and stopped it. His footprint is said to be still visible. Was he barefoot or wearing a shoe? I ate a terrible midday meal in a dark tavern surrounded by soot-faced laborers. Each looked bone-tired. They chewed slowly, absently, like zombies. Why must we work so hard, I thought. Consider the lilies of the field. They neither toil nor spin. And yet the first-century rabbi, Elazar ben Azaria, said our work is the holiest part of us. All are proud of their craft. God speaks of his work. How much more should man? I went on to Istanbul, got wired on Turkish coffee, got lost on the twisty streets beside the Bosporus. I stopped to sketch the glowing minarets and toured the golden labyrinths of Topkapi Palace, home of the Ottoman sultans, where Muhammad's sword is now kept. "Don't go to sleep one night," wrote Rumi, the 13th century Persian poet. "What you most want will come to you then. Warmed by a sun, inside you'll see wonders." I went to Rome, spent days hiding in small trattorias, scarfing mountains of pasta, gazing upon the most beautiful women and shoes I'd ever seen. Romans in the age of the Caesars believed that putting on the right shoe before the left brought prosperity and good luck. I explored the grassy ruins of Nero's bedroom, the gorgeous rubble of the Colosseum, the vast halls and rooms of the Vatican. Expecting huge crowds, I was always out the door at dawn, determined to be the first in line. But there was never a line. The city was mired in a historic cold snap. I had it all to myself. Even the Sistine Chapel, alone under Michelangelo's ceiling, I was able to wallow in my awe. I read in my guidebook that Michelangelo was miserable while painting his masterpiece. His back and neck ached. Paint fell constantly into his hair and eyes. He couldn't wait to be finished, he told friends. If even Michelangelo didn't like his work, I thought, what hope is there for the rest of us? I went to Florence, spent days seeking Dante, reading Dante, I stood before the David, shocked at the anger in his eyes. Goliath never had a chance. I went by train up to Milan, communed with Da Vinci, considered his beautiful notebooks, and wondered at his peculiar obsessions. Chief among them, the human foot. Masterpiece of engineering, he called it, a work of art. Who was I to argue? On my last night in Milan, I attended the opera at La Scala. I aired out my Brooks Brothers suit and wore it proudly amid the Uomini poured into custom-tailored tuxedos and the Donne molded into bejeweled gowns. We all listened in wonder to Turandot. As Calaf sang Nessun Dorma, set stars, at dawn I will win, I will win, I will win. My eyes welled, and with the fall of the curtain I leaped to my feet. Bravissimo! I went to Venice, spent a few languorous days walking in the footsteps of Marco Polo, and stood I don't know how long before the palazzo of Robert Browning. If you get simple beauty and naught else, you get about the best thing God invents. My time was running out. Home was calling to me. I hurried to Paris, descended far below ground to the Pantheon, put my hand lightly on the crypts of Rousseau and Voltaire. Love truth, but pardon error. I took a room in a seedy hotel, watched sheets of winter rain sluice the alley below my window, prayed at Notre Dame, got lost in the Louvre. I bought a few books at Shakespeare and Company, and I stood in the spot where Joyce slept and F. Scott Fitzgerald. I then walked slowly down the Seine, stopping to sip a cappuccino at the cafe where Hemingway and Dos Passos read the New Testament aloud to each other. On my last day, I sauntered up the Champs-Élysées, tracing the Liberator's path, thinking all the while of Patton. Don't tell people how to do things. Tell them what to do, and let them surprise you with their results. Of all the great generals, he was the most shoe-obsessed. A soldier in shoes is only a soldier, but in boots, he becomes a warrior. I flew to Munich, drank an ice-cold stein of beer at the Burger Braukeller, where Hitler fired a gun into the ceiling and started everything. I tried to visit Dachau, but when I asked for directions, people looked away, professing not to know. I went to Berlin and presented myself at Checkpoint Charlie. Flat-faced Russian guards in heavy topcoats examined my passport, patted me down, asked what business I had in communist East Berlin. None, I said. I was terrified that they'd somehow find out I had attended Stanford. Just before I arrived, two Stanford students had tried to smuggle a teenager out in a Volkswagen. They were still in prison. But the guards waved me through. I walked a little ways and stopped at the corner of Marx Engelsplatz. I looked around, all directions. Nothing. No trees, no stores, no life. I thought of all the poverty I'd seen in every corner of Asia. This was a different kind of poverty, more willful somehow, more preventable. I saw three children playing in the street. I walked over, took their picture. Two boys and a girl, 8 years old. The girl, red wool hat, pink coat, smiled directly at me. Will I ever forget her or her shoes? They were made of cardboard. I went to Vienna, that momentous coffee-scented crossroads where Stalin and Trotsky and Tito and Hitler and Jung and Freud all lived at the same historical moment and all loitered in the same steamy cafes, plotting how to save or end the world. I walked the cobblestones Mozart walked, crossed his graceful Danube on the most beautiful stone bridge I ever saw, stopped before the towering spires of St. Stephen's Church, where Beethoven discovered he was deaf. He looked up, saw birds fluttering from the bell tower, and to his horror, he did not hear the bells. At last, I flew to London. I went quickly to Buckingham Palace, Speaker's Corner, Herod's. I granted myself a bit of extra time at Commons. Eyes closed, I conjured the great Churchill. You ask, what is our aim? I can answer in one word. It is victory, victory at all costs, victory in spite of all terror, victory, without victory there is no survival. I wanted desperately to hop a bus to Stratford to see Shakespeare's house. Elizabethan women wore a red silk rose on the toe of each shoe, but I was out of time. I spent my last night thinking back over my whirlwind trip, making notes in my journal. I asked myself, what was the highlight? Greece, I thought. No question, Greece. When I first left Oregon, I was most excited about two things on my itinerary. I wanted to pitch the Japanese my crazy idea, and I wanted to stand before the Acropolis. Hours before boarding my flight at Heathrow, I meditated on that moment, looking up at those astonishing columns, experiencing that bracing shock, the kind you receive from all great beauty, but mixed with a powerful sense of recognition. Was it only my imagination? After all, I was standing at the birthplace of Western civilization. Maybe I merely wanted it to be familiar, but I didn't think so. I had the clearest thought, I've been here before. Then walking up those bleached steps, another thought. This is where it all begins. On my left was the Parthenon, which Plato had watched the teams of architects and workmen build. On my right was the temple of Athena Nike. 25 centuries ago, per my guidebook, it had housed a beautiful frieze of the goddess Athena, thought to be the bringer of Nike, or victory. It was one of many blessings Athena bestowed. She also rewarded the dealmakers. In the Oresteia, she says, I admire the eyes of persuasion. She was, in a sense, the patron saint of negotiators. I don't know how long I stood there, absorbing the energy and power of that epical place. An hour? Three? I don't know how long after that day I discovered the Aristophanes play, set in the Temple of Nike, in which the warrior gives the king a gift, a pair of new shoes. I don't know when I figured out that the play was called Knights. I do know that as I turned to leave, I noticed the temple's marble facade. Greek artisans had decorated it with several haunting carvings, including the most famous, in which the goddess inexplicably leans down to adjust the strap of her shoe. February 24th, 1963, my 25th birthday. I walk through the door on Claiborne Street, hair to my shoulders, beard 3 inches long. My mother let out a cry. My sisters blinked as if they didn't recognize me or else hadn't realized I'd been gone. Hugs, shouts, bursts of laughter. My mother made me sit, poured me a cup of coffee. She wanted to hear everything, but I was exhausted. I set my suitcase and backpack in the hall and went up to my room. I stared blearily at my blue ribbons. Mr. Knight, what is the name of your company? I curled up on the bed, and sleep came down like the curtain at La Scala. An hour later, I woke to my mother calling out, Dinner! My father was home from work, and he embraced me as I came into the dining room. He, too, wanted to hear every detail, and I wanted to tell him. But first, I wanted to know one thing. Dad, I said, did my shoes come? 1963. My father invited all the neighbors over for coffee and cake and a special viewing of Buck's slides. Dutifully, I stood at the slide projector, savoring the darkness, listlessly clicking the advance button and describing the pyramids, the Temple of Nike, but I wasn't there. I was at the pyramids. I was at the Temple of Nike. I was wondering about my shoes. 4 months after the big meeting at Onitsuka, after I'd connected with those executives and won them over, or so I thought, and still the shoes hadn't arrived, I fired off a letter. Dear sirs, regarding our meeting of last fall, have you had a chance to ship the samples? Then I took a few days off to sleep, wash my clothes, catch up with friends. I got a speedy reply from Onitsuka. Shoes coming, the letter said, in just a little more days. I showed the letter to my father. He winced. A little more days? Buck, he said, chuckling. That $50 is long gone. My new look, castaway hair, caveman beard, was too much for my mother and sisters. I'd catch them staring, frowning. I could hear them thinking, "Bum." So I shaved. Afterward, I stood before the little mirror on my bureau in the servants' quarters and told myself, "It's official. You're back." And yet, I wasn't. There was something about me that would never return. My mother noticed it before anyone else. Over dinner one night, she gave me a long, searching look. "You seem more worldly." Worldly. Gosh. Until the shoes arrived, whether or not the shoes ever arrived, I'd need to find some way to earn cash money. Before my trip, I'd had that interview with Dean Witter. Maybe I could go back there. I ran it by my father in the TV nook. He stretched out in his vinyl recliner and suggested I first go have a chat with his old friend Don Frisbee, CEO of Pacific Power and Light. I knew Mr. Frisbee. In college, I'd done a summer internship for him. I liked him, and I liked that he'd graduated from Harvard Business School. When it came to schools, I was a bit of a snob. Also, I marveled that he'd gone on rather quickly to become CEO of a New York stock exchange company. I recall that he welcomed me warmly that spring day in 1963, that he gave me one of those double-handed handshakes and led me into his office, into a chair across from his desk. He settled into his big, high-backed leather throne and raised his eyebrows. "So, what's on your mind?" "Honestly, Mr. Frisbee, I don't know what to do about or with a job or career." Weakly, almost inaudibly, I added, "My life." I said I was thinking of going to Dean Witter, or else maybe coming back to the electric company, or else maybe working for some large corporation. The light from Mr. Frisbee's office window glinted off his rimless glasses and into my eyes, like the sun off the Ganges. "Phil," he said, "those are all bad ideas." "Sir? I don't think you should do any of those things." "Oh." "Everyone but everyone changes jobs at least 3 times. So if you go to work for an investment firm now, you'll eventually leave, and then at your next job, you'll have to start all over. If you go work for some big company, son, same deal. No, what you want to do while you're young is get your CPA. That, along with your MBA, will put a solid floor under your earnings. Then, when you change jobs, which you will, trust me, at least you'll maintain your salary level. You won't go backward." That sounded practical. I certainly didn't want to go backward. I hadn't majored in accounting, however. I wasn't ready for the certification test, and I needed 9 more hours to even qualify to take the exam. So I quickly enrolled in 3 accounting classes at Portland State. "More school?" my father grumbled. Worse, the school in question wasn't Stanford or Oregon. It was puny little Portland State. I wasn't the only school snob in the family. While studying accounting, I worked at an accounting firm, Librand Ross Brothers in Montgomery. It was one of the big 8 national firms, but its Portland branch office was small. 1 partner, 3 junior accountants. Suits me, I thought. Smallness meant the firm would be intimate, conducive to learning. And it did start out that way. My first assignment was a Beaverton company, Reese's Fine Foods. And as the solo man on the job, I got to spend quality time with the CEO, Al Reeser, who was just 3 years older than me. I picked up some important lessons from him and enjoyed my time poring over his books. But I was too overworked to fully enjoy it. The trouble with a small satellite branch within a big accounting firm is the workload. Whenever extra work came rolling in, there was no one to take up the slack. During the busy season, November through April, we found ourselves up to our ears, logging 12-hour days 6 days a week, which didn't leave much time to learn. Also, we were watched closely. Our minutes were counted to the second. When President Kennedy was killed that November, I asked for the day off. I wanted to sit in front of the TV with the rest of the nation and mourn. My boss, however, shook his head. "Work first, mourn second. Consider the lilies of the field. They neither toil nor spin." I had 2 consolations. One was money. I was earning $500 a month, which enabled me to buy a new car. I couldn't justify another MG, so I bought a Plymouth Valiant. Reliable, but with some pizzazz, and a dash of color. The salesman called it Seafoam Green. My friends called it Vomit Green. It was actually the green of newly minted money. My other consolation was lunch. Each day at noon, I'd walk down the street to the local travel agency and stand like Walter Mitty before the posters in the window. Switzerland, Tahiti, Moscow, Bali. I'd grab a brochure and leaf through it while eating a peanut butter and jelly sandwich on a bench in the park. I'd ask the pigeons, "Can you believe it was only a year ago that I was surfing Waikiki, eating water buffalo stew after an early morning hike in the Himalayas? Are the best moments of my life behind me? Was my trip around the world my peak?" The pigeons were less responsive than the statue at Wat Pra Kao. This is how I spent 1963, quizzing pigeons, polishing my Valiant, writing letters. "Dear Carter, did you ever leave Shangri-La? I'm an accountant now and giving some thought to blowing my brains out." 1964. The notice arrived right around Christmas, so I must have driven down to the waterfront warehouse the first week of 1964. I don't recall exactly. I know it was early morning. I can see myself getting there before the clerks unlocked the doors. I handed them the notice, and they went into the back and returned with a large box covered in Japanese writing. I raced home, scurried down to the basement, ripped open the box. 12 pairs of shoes, creamy white with blue stripes down the sides. God, they were beautiful. They were more than beautiful. I'd seen nothing in Florence or Paris that surpassed them. I wanted to put them on marble pedestals or in gilt-edged frames. I held them up to the light, caressed them as sacred objects, the way a writer might treat a new set of notebooks or a baseball player or a rack of bats. Then I sent 2 pairs to my old track coach in Oregon, Bill Bowerman. I did so without a second thought, since it was Bowerman who'd first made me think, really think, about what people put on their feet. Bowerman was a genius coach, a master motivator, a natural leader of young men, and there was one piece of gear he deemed crucial to their development, shoes. He was obsessed with how human beings are shod. In the 4 years I'd run for him at Oregon, Bowerman was constantly sneaking into our lockers and stealing our shoes. He'd spend days tearing them apart, stitching them back up, then hand them back with some modification, which made us either run like deer or bleed like mad. Regardless of the results, he never stopped. He was determined to find new ways of bolstering the instep, cushioning the midsole, building out more room for the forefoot. He always had some new design, some new scheme to make our shoes sleeker, softer, lighter, especially lighter. 1 ounce sliced off a pair of shoes, he said, is equivalent to 55 pounds over 1 mile. He wasn't kidding. His math was solid. You take the average man's stride of 6 feet, spread it out over a mile, 5,280 feet, you get 880 steps. Remove 1 ounce from each step, that's 55 pounds on the button. Lightness, Bowerman believed, directly translated to less burden, which meant more energy, which meant more speed. And speed equaled winning. Bowerman didn't like to lose. I got it from him. Thus, lightness was his constant goal. Goal is putting it kindly. In quest of lightness, he was willing to try anything. Animal, vegetable, mineral, any material was eligible if it might improve on the standard shoe leather of the day. That sometimes meant kangaroo skin, other times cod. You haven't lived until you've competed against the fastest runners in the world wearing shoes made of cod. There were 4 or 5 of us on the track team who were Bowerman's podiatry guinea pigs, but I was his pet project. Something about my feet spoke to him, something about my stride. Also, I afforded a wide margin of error. I wasn't the best on the team, not by a long shot, so he could afford to make mistakes on me. With my more talented teammates, he didn't dare take undue chances. As a freshman, as a sophomore, as a junior, I lost count of how many races I ran in flats or spikes modified by Bowerman. By my senior year, he was making all my shoes from scratch. Naturally, I believed this new Tiger, this funny little shoe from Japan that had taken more than a full year to reach me, would intrigue my old coach. Of course, it wasn't as light as his COD shoes, but it had potential. The Japanese were promising to improve it. Better yet, it was inexpensive. I knew this would appeal to Bowerman's innate frugality. Even the shoe's name struck me as something Bowerman might flip for. He usually called his runners Men of Oregon, but every once in a while, he'd exhort us to be Tigers. I can see him pacing the locker room, telling us before a race, "Be Tigers out there." If you weren't a Tiger, he'd often call you a hamburger. Now and then, when we complained about our skimpy pre-race meal, he'd growl, "A tiger hunts best when he's hungry." With any luck, I thought, Coach will order a few pairs of Tigers for his Tigers. But whether or not he placed an order, impressing Bowerman would be enough. That alone would constitute success for my fledgling company. It's possible that everything I did in those days was motivated by some deep yearning to impress, to please Bowerman. Besides my father, there was no man whose approval I craved more. And besides my father, there was no man who gave it less often. Frugality carried over to every part of the coach's makeup. He weighed and hoarded words of praise like uncut diamonds. After you'd won a race, if you were lucky, Bowerman might say, "Nice race." In fact, that's precisely what he said to one of his milers after the young man became one of the very first to crack the mythical 4-minute mark in the United States. More likely, Bowerman would say nothing. He'd stand before you in his tweed blazer and ratty sweater vest, his string tie blowing in the wind, his battered ball cap pulled low, and nod once, maybe stare. Those ice blue eyes, which missed nothing, also gave nothing. Everyone talked about Bowerman's dashing good looks, his retro crew cut, his ramrod posture and plain jawline. But what always got me was that gaze of pure violet blue. It got me on day one. From the moment I arrived at the University of Oregon in August 1955, I loved Bowerman and feared him. And neither of these initial impulses ever went away. They were always there between us. I never stopped loving the man, and I never found a way to shed the old fear. Sometimes the fear was less, sometimes more. Sometimes it went right down to my shoes, which he'd probably cobbled with his bare hands. Love and fear, the same binary emotions, governed the dynamic between me and my father. I wondered sometimes if it was mere coincidence that Bowerman and my father, both cryptic, both alpha, both inscrutable, were both named Bill. And yet the two men were driven by different motors. My father, the son of a butcher, was always chasing respectability, whereas Bowerman, whose father had been governor of Oregon, didn't give a damn for respectability. He was also the grandson of legendary pioneers, men and women who'd walked the full length of the Oregon Trail. When they stopped walking, they founded a tiny town in eastern Oregon, which they called Fossil. Bowerman spent his early days there and compulsively returned there. Part of his mind was always back in Fossil, which was funny because there was something distinctly fossilized about him. Hard, brown, ancient, he possessed a prehistoric strain of maleness, a blend of grit and integrity and calcified stubbornness that was rare in Lyndon Johnson's America. Today, it's all but extinct. He was a war hero, too. Of course he was. As a major in the 10th Mountain Division, stationed high in the Italian Alps, Bowerman had shot at men, and plenty had shot back. His aura was so intimidating, I don't recall anyone ever asking if he'd actually killed a man. In case you were tempted to overlook the war and the 10th Mountain Division and their central role in his psyche, Bowerman always carried a battered leather briefcase with a Roman numeral X engraved in gold on the side. The most famous track coach in America, Bowerman never considered himself a track coach. He detested being called a coach. Given his background, his makeup, he naturally thought of track as a means to an end. He called himself a professor of competitive responses. And his job, as he saw it and often described it, was to get you ready for the struggles and competitions that lay ahead, far beyond Oregon. Despite this lofty mission, or perhaps because of it, the facilities at Oregon were Spartan. Dank wooden walls, lockers that hadn't been painted in decades. The lockers had no door, just slats to separate your stuff from the next guy's. We hung our clothes on nails, rusty nails. We sometimes ran without socks. Complaining never crossed our minds. We saw our coach as a general, to be obeyed quickly and blindly. In my mind, he was Patton with a stopwatch. That is, when he wasn't a god. Like all the ancient gods, Bowerman lived on a mountaintop. His majestic ranch sat on a peak high above the campus. And when reposing on his private Olympus, he could be vengeful as the gods. One story told to me by a teammate brought this fact pointedly home. Apparently there was a truck driver who often dared to disturb the peace on Bowerman Mountain. He took turns too fast and frequently knocked over Bowerman's mailbox. Bowerman scolded the trucker, threatened to punch him in the nose and so forth, but the trucker paid no heed. He drove as he pleased, day after day. So Bowerman rigged the mailbox with explosives. Next time the trucker knocked it over, boom. When the smoke cleared, the trucker found his truck in pieces, its tires reduced to ribbons. He never again touched Bowerman's mailbox. A man like that, you didn't want to get on his wrong side, especially if you were a gangly middle-distance runner from the Portland suburbs. I always tiptoed around Bowerman. Even so, he'd often lose patience with me, though I remember only one time when he got really sore. I was a sophomore, being worn down by my schedule. Class all morning, practice all afternoon, homework all night. One day, fearing that I was coming down with a flu, I stopped by Bowerman's office to say that I wouldn't be able to practice that afternoon. "Uh-huh," he said. "Who's the coach of this team?"
"You are."
"Well, as coach of this team, I'm telling you to get your ass out there. And by the way, we're going to have a time trial today." I was close to tears, but I held it together, channeled all my emotion into my run, and posted one of my best times of the year. As I walked off the track, I glowered at Bowerman. "Happy now, you son of a..." He looked at me, checked his stopwatch, looked at me again, nodded. He tested me. He'd broken me down and remade me just like a pair of shoes. And I'd held up. Thereafter, I was truly one of his men of Oregon. From that day on, I was a tiger. I heard back right away from Bowerman. He wrote to say he was coming to Portland the following week for the Oregon Indoor. He invited me to lunch at the Cosmopolitan Hotel, where the team would be staying. January 25th, 1964. I was terribly nervous as the waitress showed us to our table. I recall that Bowerman ordered a hamburger, and I said croakily, "Make it two." We spent a few minutes catching up. I told Bowerman about my trip around the world, Kobe, Jordan, the Temple of Nike. Bowerman was especially interested in my time in Italy, which, despite his brushes with death, he remembered fondly. At last he came to the point. "Those Japanese shoes," he said, "they're pretty good. How about letting me in on the deal?" I looked at him. "In? Deal?" It took me a moment to absorb and understand what he was saying. He didn't merely want to buy a dozen tigers for his team. He wanted to become my partner. Had God spoken from the whirlwind and asked to be my partner, I wouldn't have been more surprised. I stammered and stuttered and said, "Yes." I put out my hand, but then I pulled it back. "What kind of partnership did you have in mind?" I asked. I was daring to negotiate with God. I couldn't believe my nerve, nor could Bowerman. He looked bemused. He said, 50-50. "Well, you'll have to put up half the money, of course. I figure the first order will be for $1,000. Your half will be $500. I'm good for that." When the waitress dropped off the check for the two hamburgers, we split that too. 50-50. I remember it as the next day, or maybe sometime in the next few days or weeks, and yet all the documents contradict my memory. Letters, diaries, appointment books, they all definitively show it taking place much later. But I remember what I remember, and there must be a reason why I remember it the way I do. As we left the restaurant that day, I can see Bowerman putting on his ball cap. I can see him straightening his string tie. I can hear him saying, "I'll need you to meet my lawyer, John Jaqua. He can help us get this in writing." Either way, days later, weeks later, years later, the meeting happened like this. I pulled up to Bowerman's stone fortress and marveled, as I always did, at the setting. Remote. Not many folks made it out there. Along Coburg Road to Mackenzie Drive until you found a winding dirt lane that went a couple miles up the hills into the woods. Eventually you came to a clearing with rose bushes, solitary trees, and a pleasant house, small but solid, with a stone face. Bowerman had built it with his bare hands. As I slipped my Valiant into park, I wondered how on earth he'd managed all that back-breaking labor by himself. The man who moves a mountain begins by carrying away small stones. Wrapped around the house was a wide wooden porch with several camp chairs. He built that by himself, too. It afforded sweeping views of the Mackenzie River, and it wouldn't have taken much convincing to have me believing Bowerman had laid the river between its banks as well. Now I saw Bowerman standing on the porch. He said nothing, just squinted, and strode down the steps toward my car. I don't remember a lot of small talk as he got in. I just slammed it into drive and set a course for his lawyer's house. Besides being Bowerman's lawyer and best friend, Jaqua was his next-door neighbor. He owned 1,500 acres at the base of Bowerman's Mountain, prime bottom land right on the Mackenzie. Driving down the mountain, I couldn't imagine how this was going to be good for me. I got along fine with Bowerman, sure, and we had ourselves a deal, but lawyers always mess things up. Lawyers specialized in messing things up. Bowerman, meanwhile, was doing nothing to put my mind at ease. He sat ramrod straight and watched the scenery. Amid the booming silence, I kept my eyes on the road and mulled over Bowerman's eccentric personality, which carried over to everything he did. He always went against the grain, always. For example, he was the first college coach in America to emphasize rest, to place as much value on recovery as on work. But when he worked you, brother, he worked you. Bowerman's strategy for running the mile was simple. Set a fast pace for the first two laps, run the third as hard as you can, then triple your speed on the fourth. There was a zen-like quality to this strategy because it was impossible. And yet, it worked. Bowerman coached more sub-4-minute milers than anybody ever. I wasn't one of them, however, and this day I wondered if I was going to fall short once again in that crucial final lap. We found Jaqua standing out on his porch. I'd met him before, at a track meet or two, but I'd never gotten a really good look at him. Though bespectacled and sneaking up on middle age, he didn't square with my idea of a lawyer. He was too sturdy, too well-made. I learned later that he'd been a star tailback in high school, and one of the best 100-meter men ever at Pomona College. He still had that telltale athletic power. It came right through his handshake. "Buckaroo," he said, grabbing me by the arm and guiding me into his living room. "I was going to wear your shoes today, but I got cow shit all over them." The day was typical for Oregon in January. Along with the spitting rain, a deep, wet cold permeated everything. We arranged ourselves on chairs around Jaqua's fireplace, the biggest fireplace I ever saw, big enough to roast an elk. Roaring flames were spinning around several logs the size of hydrants. From a side door came Jaqua's wife carrying a tray, mugs of hot chocolate. She asked if I'd like whipped cream or marshmallows.
Neither, thank you, ma'am.
My voice was 2 octaves higher than normal. She tilted her head and gave me a pitying look. Boy, they're going to skin you alive. Jaqua took a sip, wiped the cream from his lips, and began. He talked a bit about Oregon track and about Bowerman. He was wearing dirty blue jeans and a wrinkled flannel shirt, and I couldn't stop thinking how unlawyerly he looked. Now, Jaquas said, he'd never seen Bowerman this pumped up about an idea. I liked the sound of that. But, he added, 50-50 is not so hot for the coach. He doesn't want to be in charge, and he doesn't want to be at loggerheads with you, ever. How about we make it 51-49? We give you total operating control. His whole demeanor was that of a man trying to help to make the situation a win for everyone. I trusted him. Fine by me, I said. That all? He nodded. Deal, he said. Deal, I said. We all shook hands, signed the papers, and I was now officially in a legal and binding partnership with Almighty Bowerman. Mrs. Jaquas asked if I'd care for more hot chocolate. Yes, please, ma'am. And do you have any marshmallows? Later that day, I wrote Onitsuka and asked if I could be the exclusive distributor of Tiger shoes in the western United States. Then I asked them to send 300 pairs of Tigers ASAP. At $3.33 a pair, that was roughly $1,000 worth of shoes. Even with Bowerman's kick-in, that was more than I had on hand. Again, I put the touch on my father. This time, he balked. He didn't mind getting me started, but he didn't want me coming back to him year after year. Besides, he thought the shoe thing was a lark. He hadn't sent me to Oregon and Stanford to become a door-to-door shoe salesman, he said. Jackassing around, that's what he called it. Buck, he said, how long do you think you're going to keep jackassing around with these shoes? I shrugged. I don't know, Dad. I looked at my mother. As usual, she said nothing. She simply smiled, vaguely, prettily. I got my shyness from her, that was plain. I often wished I'd also gotten her looks. The first time my father laid eyes on my mother, he thought she was a mannequin. He was walking by the only department store in Roseburg, and there she was, standing in the window, modeling an evening gown. Realizing that she was flesh and blood, he went straight home and begged his sister to find out the name of that gorgeous gal in the window. His sister found out. That's Loda Hatfield, she said. 8 months later, my father made her Loda Knight. At the time, my father was on his way to becoming an established lawyer, on his way to escaping the terrible poverty that defined his childhood. He was 28 years old. My mother, who had just turned 21, had grown up even poorer than he had. Her father was a railroad conductor. Poverty was one of the few things they had in common. In many ways, they were the classic case of opposites attracting. My mother, tall, stunning, a lover of the outdoors, was always seeking places to regain some lost inner peace. My father, small, average, with thick rimless glasses to correct his 20/450 vision, was engaged in a daily, noisome battle to overcome his past, to become respectable, mainly through academics and hard work. Second in his law school class, he never tired of complaining about the one C on his transcript. He felt the professor penalized him for his political beliefs. When their diametrically opposed personalities caused problems, my parents would fall back on the thing they had most deeply in common, their belief that family comes first. When that consensus didn't work, there were difficult days and nights. My father turned to drink. My mother turned to stone. Her facade could be deceiving, however, dangerously so. People assumed from her stoicism that she was meek, and she'd often remind them in startling ways that she was not. For instance, there was the time my father refused to cut back on his salt, despite a doctor's warnings that his blood pressure was up. My mother simply filled all the salt shakers in the house with powdered milk. And there was the day my sisters and I were bickering and clamoring for lunch, despite her pleas for quiet. My mother suddenly let out a savage scream and hurled an egg salad sandwich against the wall. She then walked out of the house, across the lawn, and disappeared. I'll never forget the sight of that egg salad slowly dripping down the wall, while my mother's sundress dissolved in the distant trees. Perhaps nothing ever revealed my mother's true nature, like the frequent drills she put me through. As a young girl, she'd witnessed a house in her neighborhood burn to the ground. One of the people inside had been killed. So she often tied a rope to the post of my bed and made me use it to rappel out of my second-floor window. While she timed me, what must the neighbors have thought? What must I have thought? Probably this. Life is dangerous. And this. We must always be prepared. And this. My mother loves me. When I was 12, Les Steers and his family moved in across the street next to my best friend, Jackie Emery. One day, Mr. Steers set up a high jump course in Jackie's backyard, and Jackie and I did battle. Each of us maxed out at 4 feet 6 inches. "Maybe one of you will break the world record one day," Mr. Steers said. I learned later that the world record at that time, 6 feet 11 inches, belonged to Mr. Steers. Out of nowhere, my mother appeared. She was wearing gardening slacks and a summery blouse. Uh-oh, I thought, we're in trouble. She looked over the scene, looked at me and Jackie, looked at Mr. Steers. "Move the bar up," she said. She slipped off her shoes, toed her mark, and burst forward, clearing 5 feet easily. I don't know if I ever loved her more. In the moment, I thought she was cool. Soon after, I realized she was also a closet trackophile. It happened my sophomore year. I developed a painful wart on the bottom of my foot. The podiatrist recommended surgery, which would mean a lost season of track. My mother had two words for that podiatrist. Unacceptable. She marched down to the drugstore and bought a vial of wart remover, which she applied each day to my foot. Then, every 2 weeks, she took a carving knife and pared away a sliver of the wart until it was all gone. That spring, I posted the best times of my life. So I shouldn't have been too surprised by my mother's next move when my father accused me of jackassing around. Quietly, she opened her purse and took out $7. "I'd like to purchase one pair of Limber-Ups, please," she said, loud enough for him to hear. Was it my mother's way of digging at my father? A show of loyalty to her only son? An affirmation of her love of track? To this day, I don't know. But no matter. It never failed to move me, the sight of her standing at the stove or the kitchen sink, cooking dinner or washing dishes in a pair of Japanese running shoes, size 6. Probably because he didn't want any trouble with my mother, my father loaned me the $1,000. This time, the shoes came right away. April 1964. I rented a truck, drove down to the warehouse district, and the customs clerk handed over 10 enormous cartons. Again, I hurried home, carried the cartons down to the basement, ripped them open. Each carton held 30 pairs of Tigers, and each pair was wrapped in cellophane. Shoeboxes would have been too costly. Within minutes, the basement was filled with shoes. I admired them, studied them, played with them, rolled around on top of them. Then I stacked them out of the way, arranging them neatly around the furnace and under the ping-pong table, as far as possible from the washer and dryer, so my mother could still do laundry. Lastly, I tried on a pair. I ran circles around the basement. I jumped for joy. Days later came a letter from Mr. Miyazaki. "Yes," he said, "you can be the distributor for Onitsuka in the West." That was all I needed. To my father's horror and my mother's subversive delight, I quit my job at the accounting firm, and all that spring, I did nothing but sell shoes out of the trunk of my Valiant. My sales strategy was simple, and I thought rather brilliant. After being rejected by a couple of sporting goods stores, kid, what this world does not need is another track shoe, I drove all over the Pacific Northwest to various track meets. Between races, I chat up the coaches, the runners, the fans, and show them my wares. The response was always the same. I couldn't write orders fast enough. Driving back to Portland, I'd puzzle over my sudden success at selling. I'd been unable to sell encyclopedias, and I despised it to boot. I'd been slightly better at selling mutual funds, but I'd felt dead inside. So why was selling shoes so different? Because I realized it wasn't selling. I believed in running. I believed that if people got out and ran a few miles every day, the world would be a better place. And I believed these shoes were better to run in. People, sensing my belief, wanted some of that belief for themselves. Belief, I decided. Belief is irresistible. Sometimes people wanted my shoes so badly that they'd write me or phone me saying they'd heard about the new Tigers and just had to have a pair. Could I please send them COD? Without my even trying, my mail order business was born. Sometimes people would simply show up at my parents' house. Every few nights, the doorbell would ring, and my father, grumbling, would get up from his vinyl recliner and turn down the TV and wonder who in the world. There on the porch would be some skinny kid with oddly muscular legs, shifty-eyed and twitchy, like a junkie looking to score. "A buck here?" the kid would say. My father would call through the kitchen to my room in the servants' quarters. I'd come out, invite the kid in, show him over to the sofa, then kneel before him and measure his foot. My father, hands jammed into his pockets, would watch the whole transaction incredulous. Most people who came to the house had found me through word of mouth, friend of a friend. But a few found me through my first attempt at advertising, a handout I designed and produced at a local print shop. Along the top, in big type, it said, "Best news in flats. Japan challenges European track shoe domination." The handout then went on to explain, "Low Japanese labor costs make it possible for an exciting new firm to offer these shoes at the low, low price of $6.95. Along the bottom was my address and phone number. I nailed them up all over Portland. On July 4th, 1964, I sold out my first shipment. I wrote to Tiger and ordered 900 more. That would cost roughly $3,000, which would wipe out my father's petty cash and patience. "The bank of Dad," he said, "is now closed." He did agree grudgingly to give me a letter of guarantee, which I took down to the First National Bank of Oregon. On the strength of my father's reputation and nothing more, the bank approved the loan. My father's vaunted respectability was finally paying dividends, at least for me. I had a venerable partner, a legitimate bank, and a product that was selling itself. I was on a roll. In fact, the shoes sold so well, I decided to hire another salesman, maybe two, in California. The problem was how to get to California. I certainly couldn't afford airfare, and I didn't have time to drive. So every other weekend, I'd load a duffel bag with Tigers, put on my crispest army uniform, and head out to the local airbase. Seeing the uniform, the MPs would wave me onto the next military transport to San Francisco or Los Angeles, no questions asked. When I went to Los Angeles, I'd save even more money by crashing with Chuck Kale, a friend from Stanford, a good friend. When I presented my running shoe paper to my entrepreneurship class, Kale showed up for moral support. During one of those Los Angeles weekends, I attended a meet at Occidental College. As always, I stood on the infield grass, letting the shoes do their magic. Suddenly, a guy sauntered up and held out his hand. Twinkly eyes, handsome face, in fact, very handsome, though also sad. Despite the enameled calm of his expression, there was something sorrowful, almost tragic around the eyes. Also something vaguely familiar. "Phil," he said. "Yes," I said. "Jeff Johnson," he said. Of course, Johnson. I'd known him at Stanford. He'd been a runner, a pretty fair miler, and we'd competed against each other at several all-comer meets. And sometimes he'd gone for a run with me and Kale, then for a bite after. "Heya, Jeff," I said. "What are you up to these days?" "Grad school," he said, "studying anthro." The plan was to become a social worker. "No kidding," I said, arching an eyebrow. Johnson didn't seem the social worker type. I couldn't see him counseling drug addicts and placing orphans. Nor did he seem the anthropology type. I couldn't imagine him chatting up cannibals in New Guinea or scouring Anasazi campsites with a toothbrush, sifting through goat dung for pottery shards. But these, he said, were merely his daytime drudgeries. On weekends, he was following his heart, selling shoes.